The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and it is my honor to introduce Marisa McClellan this evening. Marisa is best known as the personality behind the award-winning blog Food in Jars, dedicated to the joyful preservation of time in a jar, storing away the tastes of all seasons for later. She's come quite a long way since the launch of her blog in 2009. She has since become a TED speaker, a canning teacher, a contributor to the Food Network's Dish blog, and she published her first book of the same name. Her new cookbook focuses on small batches of her beloved recipes and is perfect for city households, families who get CSA shares, and those with small backyard gardens. Tonight, she is joined in conversation by her editor, Kristen Wiwara. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Marisa and Kristen to the stage. Good evening.
Hello.
So I'm here with Marisa, and we'll just get started. So Marisa, you've told the story in your first book about how you first got started canning. So tell me about your first solo flight. What was it? What did you do?
All right. Can you guys hear me? We were instructed to swing the microphones. So I got started canning. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and I started canning with my mom when I was a kid. We always had blackberries in the backyard or apple trees. And then I didn't do it for like 15 or 20 years. And then I was here living in Philadelphia, and I went blueberry picking at Mood's Farm Market in South Jersey, and I came home with 13 pounds of blueberries and had this moment where I went, oh God, what do you do with 13 pounds of blueberries? And then realized the thing you do is you make jam. And so I called my mom for the, I feel like I should be angling towards Kristen since we're having a conversation. I called my mom for the refresher course, and I ran out to the hardware store, which at the time was across the street, and I made my first batch of jam, and I just loved it. There was something so satisfying about making something and having it last longer than, you know, the 20 minutes that you get out of a meal if you're lucky. And so I kept doing it. Was that the whole question? Did I get that all?
You did. I think she did. So Marisa, you love the science behind home canning. You're one of the few people I know who loves. So tell me about how it works. What happens between fresh food and sealed jars?
All right. Well, it is. I always think it's kind of funny that I love the science behind canning, because my undergrad degree is in politics, and I have a master's degree in writing. But I do. I really love the science of canning, because it's the thing that has made science come alive for me. And so when you can something, you take a, you know, for instance, let's talk through a batch of jam. When you make jam, you take your fruit and you combine it with sugar. And the sugar is not just acting as a sweetening element, it's also doing a preservation role, and it's creating the set. Because in the preservation side of things, when you add sugar to something, sugar occupies the water. And what like mold needs to grow is it needs water to be available for it to turn into sort of fuzzy, gross mold on top of your food. And so if the sugar is occupying all of the water, there's nothing available to any bacteria, so it can't grow, which is why when you have a high sugar product, it is much less likely to go bad than a low sugar product. So like the fruit butter that only has a half a cup of sugar in it is going to go off much faster than sort of a jam that is one part fruit and one part sugar. So then the sugar, the other thing it's doing that's really kind of cool is that it is creating the set. Because has anyone ever made candy before? Candy makers? I see nodding heads, excellent. When you heat sugar and you heat it to different temperatures, you get different outcomes. So when you heat sugar to like 250 degrees, you get a caramel sauce. If you heat it to like 300 degrees, you're going to get a hard, crunchy candy. And so when you make jam, you're using the power of that sugar to heat up above the boiling point and change physical consistency. And so when you heat the sugar to around 220 degrees in combination with fruit, it thickens and it bonds with the natural pectin in the fruit, and you get jam. And so it's kind of cool. It's not just that sugar's like, oh, you know, let's make this taste good. We're going to put sugar in it. It does more than that. It's funny. When I was a kid, my mom always made jam, and she'd read the recipes and be like, I cannot bear to put this much sugar in here. And she would pull out about half the sugar, and we'd have syrup every single time. And so I grew up thinking that homemade jam was runny enough to pour. Like, that's just my understanding. That was my understanding. And it wasn't until years later when she sort of surrendered the last vestiges of her hippie ways and started using the full amount of sugar, did the jam actually set up. So that's what sugar's doing. And then the canning process, I'm used to like gesticulating. I don't want to slap the microphone here. And I do this on my feet normally. So the canning process, so once you've got your finished jam, you have set up a canning pot, which is simply a stock pot with a rack or something in the bottom that's elevating the jars off the bottom of the pot. And then you have a pot that's tall enough so you can have your jars, some water to cover the tops, and then some space for that water to boil so that you don't end up boiling water all over your stovetop. And so you take your hot jars and you put your hot jam in them, and then you slap some lids and rings on them. So not really slap, but you know, you gently lay some lids on the jars and then use rings to tighten the lids into place. But you don't tighten them as tightly as you possibly can. You always just turn them to the point where they meet resistance and no tighter. The reason for that is that once you put those full jars back in the canning pot, when you filled them up, you left a little headspace. You left about half an inch of space from the top of the product to the top of the jar. And so then as the jars boil, the oxygen that you have trapped in the top of that jar starts to sort of move around and expand and agitate. And so as it agitates, it kind of vents out of the jar. And this is what you want to see happen, because what's going to happen is throughout the boiling process, I really do gesticulate a lot. I'm going to see if I can put my hands down. Throughout the boiling process, the jars will vent all their oxygen. And so then when you take the jars out, when the canning process is finished, everything that had been expanding starts to contract. And in that contraction, the lid gets pulled into further and further contact with the rim of the jar. And what had been, because there's no oxygen there anymore, there's nothing holding the space. And so the lid goes very concave, and you get this tight vacuum seal. The way I think about it is often, it's like when you were a kid and you put a cup on your mouth, and you sucked in and sucked in and sucked in until the cup stuck to your face. That is essentially what's happening, only instead of needing sort of a human body and oxygen, you do it through the force of physics. And then the jars are sealed. And actually, once the jars are fully sealed, you can take the rings off of them, and the lids should be so tightly on there that you can lift up the jar holding onto just the edges of the lid, and the whole thing will lift up with you. That was a lot of science.
Have you got it? Did you get all of that?
Everybody feel good?
What I took from that is that sugar is good for you. Is that what everyone else took from that? Thought you heard it
yes,
here first.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So my grandfather made pear preserves by just slapping that lid on the jar and letting the heat sort of pull it in so that it's concave. And I know a lot of Italian nonnas out there made their meat sauce by just sealing the top of the jar with wax. Anyone ever see someone do that? So can we do that, Marisa? Is that safe?
No.
No?
No. You don't want to do that.
Oh,
let's talk about that.
Tell me.
So first of all, the old style, just filling up the jar and then putting the lid on and letting it seal on its own. That, in canning parlance, is called open kettle canning. And in the days when we did really high sugar preserves, and people were really very practiced at their home canning, it would be okay to do something like that, but as sugar amounts have gone down and people aren't as comfortable with the canning process or don't have as much familiarity, it's become less and less recommended, and the USDA doesn't recommend it anymore. The reason is that when you skip that boiling water bath process, you're not just skipping the thing that's going to give you a really tight, solid seal, you're also skipping your sterilization step. And so, you know, even if you've sterilized your jars and all your tools and your lids and everything before you put the preserves in the jars, your kitchen is not a sterile field. And so the minute you take a jar out of a canning pot, no matter how hot and no matter how long you boiled it, the minute it's out of the canning pot, it is no longer sterile. And so there is an opportunity for bacteria to be introduced, or, you know, yeast just kind of lives in the air, which is why you can make sourdough starter by combining water and flour and letting sit out, which is great. But you don't want the yeast in your home preserves because they're going to make it go bad. Now, the only good thing here is that with those pears, it's a high acid product. So even if something goes wrong, it's going to be something you can either see or smell immediately upon opening the jar. So like it may have been that one out of every five of those jars of pear preserves got a little moldy on top. And, you know, so the seal popped and you didn't eat those. The meat sauce sealed with wax is a whole other ball of string, shall we say. So when it comes to canning, there are two kinds of canning. There's high acid canning and low acid canning. And they are divided up by pH. So if something has a pH of 4.6 or below, it's considered to be high in acid. And if it has a pH of 4.7 or above, if it has a pH of 4.7 or above, it's considered to be low in acid. So most fruits that we encounter in life have enough acid to be canned safely in a boiling water bath because they have plenty of acid. And then pickles, you're suspending those vegetables in a highly acidic brine, and so those are safe. But the meat sauce doesn't have enough acid, and the reason it's unsafe is that it has everything to do with botulism. Are we at the right place to talk about botulism, Kristen?
Yes, I did have one question for Marisa about botulism. Have you ever killed anyone with botulism poisoning?
I have not, thankfully. I think that might take my canner's license away if there's such a thing existed.
Everyone here wants to avoid killing people with botulism. Can you tell us how to do that?
Absolutely.
Please.
So botulism, when we talk about botulism, from the canner's perspective, we're not actually worried about the active botulism toxin because that is killed at the boiling point. What we're concerned with is the botulism spores, which exist in the soil and can be picked up through the harvesting process and be transferred into your food. And now botulism spores are very hardy, and they take temperatures of about 235 to 240 degrees Fahrenheit to be killed. And so you are never going to get that in a boiling water bath canner. But if you have enough acid in the jar, they cannot germinate. So they like three conditions. They need three conditions in order to germinate into the toxin. They need a low oxygen environment or oxygen-free environment, really, which is what you create when you can something. They need a room temperature environment, which the whole point of canning something is to be able to store it at room temperature, but then they need that low acid environment. And so as long as you have enough acid in the jar, you're never going to kill anyone. It will be impossible for botulism to develop in a jar that is a high acid preserve because it's not a risk, it's not a maybe, it's not a, well, it could. It's absolutely positively. Botulism will never be present in a jar if there's enough acid in there. And so anytime you read a recipe, if it says it's safe for processing in a boiling water bath canner, and the recipe is from a trusted source and not from a no-name website that you found by Googling, my website, it doesn't count in that category, by the way. You know, as long as it's from a trusted source and it's designed for boiling water bath canning, then it's going to have enough acid in it to be safe for water bath canning and be safe for shelf storage. But so on the other side of things, the things that are low in acid, because they don't have enough acid to inhibit the botulism spores to germinate into the botulism toxin, you have to treat them differently. And since those botulism spores aren't killed at the boiling point, you need to find a way to elevate the temperature so that you can get above the boiling point, and that's where the pressure canner comes in. Because what a pressure canner does is it allows you to create pressure in a pot and elevate the temperature to around 250 degrees. And so that's how people can preserve things like tuna or salmon or chicken stock or beans or meat sauce and do it safely.
All right. I feel better. We're going to take questions at the end, if you don't mind. So from poison to pickles. I love pickles. You probably love pickles. Marisa loves pickles. Tell me about pickles. It's a particular passion of yours, pickles. How do you make a good pickle?
Well, so I do love a good pickle. I've come from a family where no sandwich is complete without slices of carefully blotted dill pickle inserted into the sandwich. But I am of the firm belief that pickles are a lot about texture. It's not just vital to get really good flavor in your pickles. You want sort of crunch or at least, consistency. You don't want a soft, soggy, horrible, slippery, nothing pickle. You can see I have strong feelings about this. And so often people come up to me and tell me that they started canning, they gave it a try, and they made cucumber pickles, and they were really horrible. And I asked them questions like, what happened? And they say things like they were really soggy, And so then we talk about, well, it probably was that either the cucumbers weren't absolutely fresh, that perhaps you didn't trim the ends off, and there lives an enzyme in the blossom end of a cucumber that likes to soften things. So if you don't trim the blossom end of your cucumber off, you are always going to have soft pickles. It feels like this is an analogy for something. But then the other thing with pickles is that cucumbers, they're a delicate vegetable. And so the more you cut them up, the more you cut across their cell walls, the less physical consistency they have. So if you've made a really thin pickle chip, that pickle is not going to be particularly crunchy. So I will often tell people that if they're really looking for, you know, a really good flavored, crunchy pickle, the thing to do is to make a refrigerator pickle that never gets going in a boiling water bath, because the heat of that canner is going to really soften those cucumbers. And then you want to let it sit in your refrigerator for a couple of weeks, because one of the things that happens when you pickle something is you always add salt to your brine. And the salt's not just there for flavor. What the salt is doing is it's pulling the water content out of the vegetable so that the vinegar can go in. So I often hear from people that they thought their pickles were too salty, and it's that they didn't give them enough time in the fridge or on the shelf to allow the salt to pull the water out and the vinegar to go in and get sort of a diluted effect. So that was sort of a long, rambling, how do you get a good pickle? But basically, for cucumbers, you want to avoid heat as much as possible. You want to let them sit for a while, and you want to trim the ends off so that you don't have that enzyme activating in the jars that can lead to a softer, less crunchy cucumber. The thing to think about when it comes to these cucumber pickles is when you buy them at the grocery store, you can either get pickles in the refrigerated section that are going to be really crunchy, or you can get pickles that are in the center of the grocery store that are in the preserved section, and they're never going to be as crunchy because they were treated, they were given a heat process to make shelf stable. And so sometimes what you want is you want a shelf stable pickle, and that is perfectly acceptable. But you know, have to know that you're always going to trade off a little bit in texture if you're going for a really durable shelf stable pickle. But there is hope. Because you can pickle things other than cucumbers and make shelf-stable pickles and get really great texture. My favorite pickle in the world is a pickled green bean, a dilly bean, because those green beans, you can expose them to heat for 15 minutes. You can run them in a boiling... You can go over your time in a boiling water bath canner, and they are still going to be crunchy and delicious. So,
has anyone made that recipe from the first book, Dilly Beans? You have? I have. They're really delicious. And another thing that she pickles that I think is fantastic is cauliflower. Pickled cauliflower. Look it up.
Yeah, there's recipes in both books.
So to change topics a little bit, let's go back to sugar.
Yeah.
I must have a sweet tooth. I've heard you speak at a few different events, and one thing that is so predictable, everyone wants to talk about sugar. They want to know, how can I reduce the sugar in my preserves? Can I use anything besides granulated refined white sugar? What about honey? What about Splenda? What about it?
So the short answer is yes, you can use things other than granulated sugar in your preserves. I do a lot of preserving with honey. The thing to know is that when you swap out honey for sugar, you have to do it in smaller batches, because first of all, honey is sweeter than sugar, so you always use less. You never do a one-to-one swap. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't just say, oh, this recipe calls for 2 cups of sugar, so let me use 2 cups of honey. The easiest way to just do the calculation is to use 1/3 less honey than the recipe calls for in sugar. I could get into like how I do the conversion, where I take how many cups of sugar there are, I calculate the weight of that sugar, and then I translate that into the weight of the honey. But we don't need to go there. Just use 1/3 less. And you want to do it in small batches, because honey isn't just sweeter than sugar. It also has more liquid, obviously, because granulated sugar is a dry product, whereas honey is liquid. So when you add more liquid, you're going to make it harder for your jam to set up. Because when you're making jam or any sort of sweet preserve, the name of the game is evaporation. You are trying to evaporate out as much water content from the fruit as possible in the shortest amount of time, so that you concentrate the sugars, you cook the water out, you elevate the temperature of the sugars, and you get that all happening before you cook the fruit down so much that it has sort of no fresh flavor left. And so you're never going to have a lot of success when you pour in a ton of sugar into a big pot of fruit and then try to bring it to a boil and have all these things happening. You're going to scorch the bottom before you get to where you want to be in terms of temperature and consistency. But honey does work, and it sets up beautifully. The one thing to know about honey is that it's always good if you make a honey sweetened preserve to can it in small jars. I'm talking 4 or 8 ounces. Because honey on its own never goes bad, but as soon as you heat it up and dilute it, it loses that power of preservation. And so it'll keep fine in the jars once they're sealed, but as soon as you open it up, you have maybe 2 or 3 weeks before mold is going to set in. And so I always can honey sweetened preserves in 4 or 8 ounce jars to make sure that I'm going to be able to eat them all before I sort of, you know, succumb to the ravages of mold. And then, oh, Splenda. So sugar alternatives don't work. My friend Jamie is laughing at me. Sugar alternatives don't work as well as sort of things that have a true sugar content in them. So, you know, you're going to have good success with honey or agave or maple sugar, coconut sugar. But once you start using something that is not actually a true sugar but a sugar substitute, it doesn't have that same chemical composition that allows you to change the temperature and change consistency as you boil up towards 220 degrees. And so if you want to use a sweetener like that, you have to get into the business of using low or no sugar pectins. My favorite is Pomona's pectin, because the way it works is instead of needing the sugar to bond with the pectin, it has a two-part thing happening where you make a calcium solution and you cook the fruit with the calcium and then you add the pectin with the sweetener, and the calcium and the pectin bond. So it's sort of a different way of creating a set. It's going to give you more of a consistency like an all-fruit spread that you get at the grocery store. It's a little bit firmer, a little bit more sliceable, if we will, but it's still going to give you something that's really nice. I don't recommend using things like stevia with fruit preserves, though. For some reason, it goes bitter when you combine it with fruit, and so it changes over time. I've done some trials with it, and it doesn't taste very good. It, 6 months on, it's really kind of terrible. That was a lot about sugar. I can really talk about this kind of things for a very long time.
But again, we can conclude that sugar is good for you, right?
In small amounts.
All right. So it is hot. I hear that the air conditioner is hot in here. It's hot outside. The markets, they are bursting at the seams. Peaches, I had my first peach last week. Berries, cherries, all that is out there. When you're not traveling, what are you canning right now?
I stood in my kitchen and pitted 5 pounds of sour cherries today. I was very excited to get my hands on some because I was really afraid that I was going to miss the season entirely this year. So that was fun. I got my sour cherry fix, and I'm making a massive batch of the bourbon sour cherries from Preserving by the Pint, which is my favorite thing in the world. Mm-hmm. I gave a jar. So I got to have dinner recently with Ruth Reichel, which was sort of like the biggest thrill of my food writing life. And I gave her a jar of these bourbon sour cherries. And I'm actually starting to tear up a little as I say this. She actually wrote me an email and said that she liked them so much she was hiding them from her family. So they are Ruth Reichel approved. I was very excited about that. But they're delicious, and they're a really easy preserve, and they're actually relatively low in sugar, comparable to a jam. Mm-hmm.
What do you do with bourbon sour cherries besides just eat the
bourbon?
Besides
just eat them?
Yeah.
I like to, you know, I put a couple with some of the syrup into a glass of sparkling water often during the summertime, or I will spoon a few into yogurt. It's not a lot of bourbon. It cooks off. It's flavor. It's just flavor. Honestly, I mostly eat them out of the jar throughout the winter when I think that nothing is ever going to be bright or fresh anymore.
Your secret is safe with us.
Thank you.
So one of my favorite things that we did in Preserving by the Pint was to talk about other uses for jam other than just toast, muffins, etc. And one of the things that Marisa put in there was a recipe for chicken thighs that her mother made growing up. It's a marinade made with jam. What are some other things that you can do with preserves that does not involve toast?
There is a world of things you can do.
Just give us a few.
Okay. So you can make sort of an upside-down cake. Instead of doing like a pineapple upside-down cake, you can put a layer of jam in the bottom of your cake pan and then bake a cake into it
and then flip
it over, and it sort of self-sauces. I like things that self-sauce. you can use up the last, you can whisk some fruit preserve into like olive oil and vinegar and make a fruity vinaigrette. You can add a spoonful or two to a smoothie as a sweetener. That's a great thing to do. Pardon me, your chinos. It's a great thing to do if you've got a jam that hasn't set up in the consistency that you want. So for instance, a very firm jam, that works really well in like a thumbprint cookie or a bar cookie. But if you also just have more, you made a big batch of jam and it set up way more firmly than you thought it was going to, you know, a tablespoon into a smoothie acts as a really nice sweetener. On the savory side of things, you can, or like kind of sweet and savory, you can always make sort of spreads or dips, like whip together some goat cheese and either a jam or a chutney is really good to make sort of a dip. I'm a big fan of pairing like chutneys or jams with goat cheese in some way. Mm-hmm. You can roll a log of goat cheese in sort of a chutney and create a spread that way. Mm-hmm.
And that's a party take-along that you can grab as you're walking out the door.
Exactly. My favorite thing to do for potlucks is to buy a log of goat cheese and a baguette and bring a jar of jam or chutney and then call my contribution complete. Or sometimes I just bring pickles, as Jamie will know. I recently brought just a big jar of broccoli pickles to her house, and her daughter proceeded to eat them all, which was great. I like a toddler who likes her pickles.
That's great. So that is part one of our discussion tonight. I really enjoyed talking with you, but now I want you to be able to talk with Marisa. So we are going to open the floor for questions, and my friend in the blue shirt is first, right here. And there's a microphone, if you'll just be sure to speak into the microphone for our podcast listeners.
I had a question earlier, and if I can get a follow-up as well. When you were talking about botulism, I just want to emphasize that raw honey is a real problem for children, especially infants, with immature guts and should be avoided for anybody under the age of 12 months just because of infant botulism, which is a very serious problem. Not an issue in terms of your cooking, but
yes,
in general.
That is true.
What I wanted to ask is, when you make a combination of jams, are there any fruits or fruits and vegetables that you would not combine? Like, I know from the old days, pineapple and Jell-O you can't use. But are there any chemical imbalances that would be created by trying to combine two products, two fruits, fruit and vegetable, or whatever?
So, to the best of my knowledge, there's nothing that you should avoid combining because chemically it's going to screw up the set or the ability of the jam to work. But there are certain fruits where you either need to avoid them for jam making, or you need to add extra acid to them because they're sort of in what we call the gray zone between 4.7 and 5.0 pH. And so they're things like white peaches and white nectarines, Asian pears, figs, and like melons, cantaloupe, honeydew, things like that are a little bit lower in acid, have a slightly higher pH. And so those are things where if you're making a combined fruit jam and you're doing something with, for instance, apricots and white peaches, apricots and yellow peaches have plenty of acid to be canned safely in a boiling water bath, but that the swapping out white, you know, yellow peaches for white peaches could change the pH enough to make it unsafe. And so that's the kind of thing where you want to be aware of the general pH. And I often consult, you can get pH meters to check, but I often just consult. The FDA has a general pH range sheet on their website that you can search for. So you can go and look up and say, oh, what's the general sort of pH range of this fruit? If I combine these two, is this going to potentially lead me down the path of slight unsafety? I don't think I've ever put those words together like that in that way. That didn't quite work. But you know what I mean. And then the other thing to know is that, you know, someone just emailed me the other day, and I always make a joke that, oh, the only way to make a jam really unsafe is to add like onions to it. And then someone emailed me today and said, I had a lovely orange marmalade with onions in it recently, and how can I make that? And I went, oh, look, someone is actually adding onions to a fruit preserve like that that's not a chutney. And so you want to be careful about those low acid foods like onion or garlic, adding them to something, because you can actually pull the acid levels down into unsafe territory if not careful.
I have a question about the tools that you use. So I have some of my grandmother's jars, mm-hmm. and then I like to I always buy jars from yard sales and all of that. So, and I've heard conflicting thoughts. Yes, you can use the collars and the tops. No, you can't. So I'm asking the expert.
Okay. So you can. So as far as like the vintage jars go, if you're buying jars at a, you know, like a rummage sale or something like that, you always want to make sure you check them to make sure there aren't any chips in the rim, because that can lead to the seal not holding. And if you're using really old jars, some of the older jars, the rims were actually thicker than they are now, and so they might be too thick for the sealing compound to work effectively. So you save the really like cool old vintage jars for dry goods storage or something like that. And then as far as the old lids and rings go, the rings, as long as they fit and they hold the lid down, they can be used regardless of how old they are. The lids are a single-use item. The jars and the rings can be reused endlessly, but lids only have one trip through the canner in them before that sealing compound really doesn't give you the correct seal anymore. So, and if you found like new old stock somewhere where, and I've seen this, the hardware store up on Fairmont Avenue for a while had this stash of lids that looked like they were from the early 80s. And I bought them as a relic, but I don't use them because that sealing compound eventually sort of dries out. And so you want to, you know, the best thing to do is to always use new or newish, you know, in the sense of, you know, a couple seasons old lids, but the jars and the rings can be sort of as old as, you know, seem that if they're in good shape. Does that? All right, cool.
Great. So use away. And yes, our next question is from this lady in the turquoise top.
Hi, I have a follow-up actually to that question.
Yeah.
I have never canned before. I have done like 6 jars, so thank you.
Great, you're welcome.
I used your recipes. I bought a jar that was glass with the hinge mm-hmm. with metal clamp on it. It had one of those rubber rings.
Yes.
And could not get it to seal. And I'm just wondering if there's something less desirable about using those.
So I think you're talking about like the Le Parfait jars. Typically, the lid's a big piece and it kind of has a hinge and it opens this way and then it locks down. Those aren't approved by the USDA for home use. They can be used. No one sue me, please. But part of it is that not all of them are designed for canning. Some are designed for sort of just dry goods storage, and some are designed for canning. It could have been that the rubber seal had been on there for a while and so didn't have a lot of elasticity. And you treat those rubber seals on those jars as if they were a lid. You do want to heat them up before canning, sort of soften them a little bit. And then if they do seal, you'll be able to tell because you'll be able to unclamp it and the lid will stay put and the little tab on that rubber seal, it'll be pointing down. And so you can tell that they're sealed even if you haven't unlocked the lid. But they're just a little bit trickier. I find that with them, you leave a little less headspace than you would with a mason jar. But I don't do a ton with them because I've canned in Weck jars, which are the European really beautiful glass jars with glass tops and the little clamps that hold them down. And I've even done the vintage ball baling wire jars. And so they have that glass lid that clamps down with the baling wire and little rubber seal. But those have worked better for me than the Le Parfait jars that you're mentioning. For some reason, they're just tricky.
Hi, Marisa.
Hi, Phyllis.
I may have missed because I'm sorry I was a wee bit late. Have you talked about chow chow or pickle relish?
I haven't.
Would you?
Sure. Well, okay. So one of the interesting things about chow chow that I have found as I've traveled the country talking about canning is that every region has a different idea of what chow chow is. So in Pennsylvania, we tend to think of chow chow more as a relish. Where it's like a sort of a chopped up pickled vegetable that you serve alongside roast meats or just sort of dinner. It gives things a little flair. In other parts of the country, they think of chow chow more like sometimes it has fruit in it, sometimes it's bigger chunks of things, it's whole preserved sort of tangy pickled fruit. So I'm finding that everybody thinks chow chow is a different thing, and that whatever you think of chow chow, you cannot, what you grew up with, it does not change. Like, that is your definition of chow chow forever. And then as far as, like, pickle relishes go, every region also seems to have its sort of signature kind of garden relish, depending on what grows well in that area. So I've made a lot. I like to play with relishes. I feel like they're the unsung hero of the canning world. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you have a jar of relish, you can do a lot with it. You can, again, you can make a dip. You can serve it alongside food. You can sort of even turn it into a little bit of a side salad. So I have a recipe on my website for a fennel relish, which I really like, where you just kind of grate it up, stir in some parsley and a little onion and lots of vinegar and spices. But yeah, does that, I mean, that's, I'm just kind of rambling on the topic of pickle relish now. So does that get you? So how I go about experimenting and playing with different flavor combinations for new relishes and things like that. Basically, I think, what would taste good? And I know it's going to need to have this much vinegar or lemon juice to serve as my acid base, so I pick, am I going to use an apple cider vinegar or a white wine vinegar or, you know, just a white distilled if I don't want the vinegar to add any flavor other than sort of tang to the party. And then I think about, you know, what haven't I seen a lot of, or what's the unique twist that I can bring to this particular food that's going to be different. I have... Let's see. Sometimes it's simply, oh my gosh, I have 10 green peppers from my CSA, and I have to do something with them, and let's make a relish. That a couple years ago, that was how my cucumber and green pepper relish was born. Is that I didn't have space for any more green peppers and I had to use them up.
That is a great relish, I will just tell you. And I've made it with red peppers, and it's so ugly.
Oh, I bet that's really good.
But it's delicious. So just know that it'll be really ugly if you make it with red peppers instead. Other questions? Yes, in the back there.
So I've canned a whole bunch of stuff. I've made your tomato jam, like, a million times, and I've definitely added onions. And then I read later I wasn't supposed to, and I was like, oops. but... I've had cans that break, you know, like the whole bottom shatters, just comes right off. And I don't know if that's because of the airspace or because I didn't have enough water or because I had two layers of jars. Like, can you do any of those things?
So probably it's not your fault that the jars are breaking. From what I hear, there were some jars out there in the last couple of years that weren't tempered well. And so in the heat of the canning pot, like the bottom would just fall out. Is that kind of what happened to you? Or would they really shatter? Yeah, the bottom just came right out. I was hearing reports of that a lot from people last year and the year before, and apparently the jars weren't tempered properly. And sometimes that also happens. So it can happen if the jars were sort of, you know, not a good batch. It can also happen if you use a lot of utensils in the bottom of your jars. If you're scraping around there with like a metal knife or a spoon, you can put little scratches into the bottom of the jar that weaken it over time. And so eventually the bottoms will drop out. So for instance, if you are the kind of person who takes like soup or yogurt or something to work or, you know, to school or wherever you're going in your life in a mason jar, and then eventually that mason jar makes it back into your canning world, that jar might be weaker because you've been sort of eating out of it and scraping at it. And so I actually try to keep the Tupperware jars and my like leftover jars separate from my canning jars, which sounds crazy that I have like classes of jars in my home. My husband will tell you we have a lot of jars. But so that's the other thing that can happen is that if you're using them a lot for other things. The airspace should not cause your jars to break. The issue with the airspace, if you don't leave enough headspace in there when the jars are processing, simply the jars won't seal. You know, if you don't have enough oxygen to vent and then create a vacuum, you're not going to get a good seal. And then, you know, if you have air bubbles that are trapped inside the product throughout the jar, they're not going to break the jar either. The only thing that can happen is that if you have air bubbles trapped down in the jar, they're going to expand and agitate just like the oxygen in the headspace is. And so as they expand, they're going to try to exit the jar too, and they will push product out of your jar. So if you have, if you're having trouble with airspace, really what's going to end up happening is you're going to have like liquid or product loss in the canner. Or once you take the jars out of the canner, they're going to do what's known in canning as siphoning. They're going to kind of spit and hiss and lose their product as the jars cool. But it shouldn't lead to breakage.
One other thing that you mentioned that I just want to run by you that I think other people will be wondering about too, layering jars in your canning pot. What about that? Can you do it?
Yeah, you can.
You can.
As long as the jars are fully submerged, you can layer them. I like to do it, I like to think like a bricklayer when I'm layering jars in a canning pot though. You want to stagger them. So you put one layer down, and then when you go to put the second layer, you want to make sure that you have one jar sitting on top of two so that the water is still going to be able to circulate and you're not going to have a jar applying pressure to the jar below it.
That's a great idea. I feel like we should have a moment of silence for your lost tomato jam in the canning pot. That just breaks my heart.
Yeah, that jam is good stuff.
And next questions.
So I may have overcommitted in terms of tomato growing in my garden this summer, and I'm a little nervous about it. We probably have 10 to 12 tomato plants, and they're enormous right now. I have done your tomato jam recipe a million times, and I love it, and I think it's delicious. It's my number one Christmas present. But I followed your recipe last year for canning whole tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
And I would say like half of my jars I had tomato float. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how I might not do that to this year's massive crop.
So tomato float is that dreaded thing when you probably had some liquid loss too, where you end up with 2 or 3 inches of water at the bottom of your jars and then a layer of tomatoes sort of floating up above it. In the scheme of things, it's not the worst thing that can happen. The tomatoes are still edible. They're still going to be good. There's nothing wrong with them. But tomatoes, by their nature, have air trapped inside of them. And so there are a couple of things you can do to help mitigate it. But even on, you know, they're always going to float a little bit because as you heat, especially if you're doing a raw pack tomato where you're just peeling them, you're getting them into jars, you're topping them off with water, and then you're running them through a boiling water bath canner, they're always going to get shrink a little bit as you heat them. So there's always going to be some float, but there are a couple of things that you can do to sort of limit it to as much as you can. One is that you actually should maybe switch to a hot pack. So instead of packing the tomatoes cold after the blanch, you peel them and then you put them in a pot and you just bring them up to a boil. Because what that does is it helps the tomatoes release some of their air, shrink a little bit, so you'll be able to get more into the jar before canning, and so then there's just going to be less sort of shrinkage as they process. The second thing you can do is use regular mouth jars as opposed to wide mouth jars if you weren't, because regular mouth jars, they're not just designed to make it harder to get your hand in the jar. They, the shoulders on the jars actually provide a physical barrier that help keep the tomato or anything you can in those jars down in the liquid of the jar. So those shoulders can really help keep your tomatoes further submerged. And then the other thing to prevent a little that liquid loss too is once the processing time for the tomatoes is finished, instead of just pulling the jars out of the canning pot immediately, if you pull the pot off the heat and let them cool with the lid off for like 10 minutes, the jars cool a little bit more gradually, and so you'll have less temperature differential when you take them out of the pot, and so the jars will hiss and lose less liquid that way. So that hopefully that'll help a little bit.
And let me make my plug for salsa. There is nothing better than Marisa's salsa in January when it is so cold. So think about that. Next questions. Yes, our friend in the blue again.
Do you recommend any changes in a high-altitude environment?
Yes, that's a really good topic to bring up. And in fact, because the boiling point lowers the higher in elevation you go, the longer you need to process your jars, because here in Philadelphia, we're basically at sea level or thereabouts, and so water is boiling at 212 degrees. But the higher up in elevation you go, the lower your boiling point drops. So when you get to, you know, whatever it is, 5,000 feet in elevation, I believe your water is boiling at like 198 degrees or something crazy like that. So the higher up in elevation you are, the longer you have to extend your canning time, because if you're not getting as hot, you have to increase the heat exposure in order to kill off the same amount of bacteria. So I don't know the changes off the top of my head. I know I can quote you how much lemon juice you add to tomatoes to make them safe for canning, but I don't know the altitude adjustments. But it's on my website and it's in both books. And so just know that for every 1,000 feet you go up in elevation, you add a minute or two to your processing time to counterbalance the fact that you're not getting as hot.
I'm intimidated by chutneys. Sometimes I feel like I've just been smacked in the mouth when I... Do you have any good introductory chutneys to acclimate my taste buds to?
Yes. Okay, chutneys. So there are a number of chutneys in both books. The one that sort of springs to mind immediately for sort of a good basic introductory chutney, particularly for this time of year, is in Preserving by the Pint. There is a black plum chutney, and you get a lot of fruit flavor from it. It's not too aggressive, and the nice thing about that recipe, too, is it says to use black plums. I've made it with apricots. I've made it with peaches. I've done it with all number of sort of summer stone fruit, and it works beautifully with everything. So depending on what you like, you can really customize it. The other thing to know about chutney, I often have found that when you first open a jar of chutney, all you get is sort of the intensity, the acid, the sort of whatever spice is predominant. So I treat chutney like wine, and I always open it and let it breathe before I eat it so that it can sort of release and relax a little bit, and it'll taste a little bit better that way.
That's a great question. Next question.
Anybody else?
Well, I have one while you're thinking of your next questions. So Marisa tours for her books. Right now she has been all over the country. From where to where? Where have you been?
So far this year, I have been to Boston, Charlottesville, Asheville, Atlanta, Birmingham, Memphis, Columbus, Ohio, Pittsburgh, Seattle, Portland, Eugene, San Francisco, LA, New York. I think that might be it.
So when you're not in any of those places, and let's say it's December, it's January, it's the off season, it's not when everyone and their mother is canning, what inspires you to can during those dark months? What do you turn to?
Well, I find that I get just generally a little bit itchy for the canning pot, even in the off season. In sort of late fall, when persimmons start to appear, I get very excited. And each season has something to give, even if it's sort of a quieter season. The only time of year that it's really hard to find something interesting to can is March and April. The rest of the year always has something. And so in the fall, you've got apples and pears and quince, and then the persimmons roll in, and then there's pomegranates, and then the Meyer lemons appear in January, and I get very excited about the Meyer lemons. And you can, if you know where to special order, you can get some Seville oranges and do bitter orange marmalade. And then in March and April, I just really focus on eating what's left. Although, I mean, I always have a backlog. But I guess the thing that inspires me, I guess I'm just uniquely tuned to always be looking for new flavor combinations or new fun things. I look at canning not just as like an act of, making something to eat later, but also I think of it as waste prevention often too. So, maybe you overbought or you got a deal on something and you're not eating it as fast as you thought you were going to. Or in February, you succumb to the California strawberries that smell amazing and taste like nothing. And instead of throwing them away, you can, sugar them up, make something with them, combine them with whatever else you have, and it actually becomes something you want to eat, and you don't end up throwing away good food, even if they taste a little bit like foam rubber.
What's your favorite thing in the new book, Preserving by the Pint?
Well, those bourbon sour cherries I mentioned earlier are definitely a favorite. I also love the pizza sauce. The pizza sauce, it's sort of a slow burn kind of preserve, but you know, it's not sexy. Pizza sauce, it's sort of pantry filling. It's not something that you're going to be like, oh, I'm going to give you a jar of pizza sauce for Christmas. Unless maybe you're a, you know, a diehard pizza maker and pizza sauce would be really exciting for you. But what I love about the pizza sauce is that you can buy a couple pounds of cracked tomatoes at the farmer's market. Or, you know, you have a few tomatoes in your garden and you don't have enough to make a big batch of anything. But you have 2 pounds. You can take those 2 pounds, and the easiest way to peel tomatoes when you're making little batches with them is instead of getting out a big blanching pot, I cut them in half, I core them, and I put them in a heat-proof baking dish. I bring a tea kettle to a boil, I pour the water over the tomatoes, and I put a cookie sheet on top, and I let it sit for 10 minutes. And the heat loosens the peels, they release, and you have peeled tomatoes without having, you know, done a lot. And then you just kind of smash them up in a skillet with some spices, a little olive oil, some citric acid, and cook it down, and it's done. And I love that. I love that it's so useful and it's so easy. And you can do it in half an hour on a Saturday afternoon after you get home from the farmer's market. And suddenly you've done something where it's like, this, I can eat this. This is going to be really useful throughout the year. So I love that.
That's a good answer.
Are you self-taught as a cook, or who did you learn? Who taught you how to cook?
I am totally self-taught. I learned from my mom. And I come from a family of people on both sides who take food very seriously. My mom's family had a Russian restaurant here in Philadelphia for about 50 years called the Russian Inn. It closed in 1968, so most people of my generation have no idea what I'm talking about. But and then my dad's family were always sort of adventurous eaters. So I grew up in a world where you had to take a bite of everything at the meal, no matter whether you knew that you didn't like it, because eventually maybe your palate would mature and you'd come to like it. And my parents felt really bad after they realized that as a child I was allergic to raw tomatoes, and they had been making me taste them over and over and over again. But I learned to cook in a general sense from my mom. My mom is a really good sort of able cook. And then my dad was always the one responsible for holiday meals, and I really got into sort of doing Thanksgiving with my dad every year when I was a kid. But both of them will readily admit that I've kind of taken it further than either of them ever did. And, it's just one of those things. I was just interested. My first sentence was, "More mayonnaise, please." So when you start out life like that, you're destined to want to,
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.
Talk about food and figure out how things taste when you put them together.
That's fun. So we're going to wrap this up. Thank you so much for spending your evening with us. Thanks, Marisa.
Thanks, Kristen. Thanks, guys.